You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Just by way of introduction, this is a Psalm of David, and this dates to 3,000 years ago. So we're reading an ancient piece of literature. This is different than like our modern poetry today. Today's poetry is a little bit different. For example, now he's thinking about me every night, oh. Is it that sweet? I guess so. Say you can't sleep, baby, I know, that's that me, espresso. See how it rhymes? I'm working late because I'm a singer. Oh, he looks so cute wrapped around my finger. My twisted humor make him laugh so often. My honey bee, come and get this pollen. Move it up, down, left, right, oh. Switch it up like Nintendo. Say you can't sleep, baby, I know. That's that me. Espresso. Now, that would be modern poetry. I'm going to keep this for later. That'll be for date night. Anyways, that's gross. Anyways, we're studying ancient poetry here. This ancient poetry is by David, and he's going to lay out what it means to engage with God, for God to know you. We read in verse 1 of chapter 139, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me." This is an inclusio with the end of the psalm where we read in verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." So you have searched me, you have known me, and then at the end he uses an imperative, "Search me. Know me, because you have, I'm asking you to do it again." Inclusio is basically a way to say, these are the bookends on the shelf, or the bookends on the psalm, and everything in between is about this, is about God knowing me. In this case, David saying, God knows me personally. He knows me. He searches me. We read in verse 2, "You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts, even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything that I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it." Lord, look at that. This is what theologians refer to as the omniscience of God. Omni in Latin means all. Omnis means all. Science means knowledge. So God is all-knowing. What does he know? He knows David's actions. When I sit, when I stand, something is simple and mundane as when you're standing or sitting. God knows that. He knows the internal reflections of the mind. You know my thoughts. You know my geography, when I travel, when I rest at home. You know everything that I do. He even knows the future free will decisions of David. Here he says, "You know what I'm going to say even before I say it." God knows you totally, truly, and exhaustively. How do you react to that when you hear that? For some people, this is a very comforting message. For other people, this is a very frightening message. God knows me totally, truly, and exhaustively. What if? There really is the all-knowing, omniscient God, and he knows everything about you completely. Think about it like this. It's hard to grasp that God could know everything, but imagine if we looked up your online search history. Everything you've Googled, every DM, every post, every, you know, I don't know if people still use Facebook, but, you know, posts on there, X, Twitter, DM, everything out there you've ever done on the internet, every video, every picture, every search, what if that was all public record? And everyone could just see everything that you've been looking at and getting into. With me? Let's crank it up a notch, all right? What if there was 24/7, 52 weeks in a year, surveillance over you? Every word, every action, everything that you did, all the time was being monitored. And this was public record. Every fight you got into, I don't want to get into too much gruesome content, but even as I say that, you probably recognize very quickly Boy, I would not want that released to the public. Wow. Let's crank it up another notch. Imagine Elon Musk creates some kind of a sci-fi Neuralink. I don't know. We're really kind of having fun here. But it's a machine that goes into your brain, somehow gets your thoughts, and transcribes them out onto a computer screen. So every thought that you have, lust, contempt, worry, fear, hatred, bigotry, I mean, you go right on down the line. It's all on the computer screen. And it's like a blog that just keeps on getting bigger and bigger. And everyone can see it. Everyone in your life can see it. I don't know if, like me, you start to feel like, oh, man. I mean, just the first part, James, the first part about the internet searches or what I've been talking to, and maybe that alone is enough, but to be surveilled. And then to get into the inner thoughts of the mind, for all of this to be exposed, think about that. And as you do, how would that affect your friendships? How many friends would you have if this was all online, a big blog of all your thoughts? You know, I really don't think she looks good in that shirt. You know, I'm really jealous of his girlfriend. I'm attracted to that person in a way that I shouldn't be. I really voted for so-and-so, even though I lied and said the other person. You know, I mean, like, basically, everything is out there on the table. How many friends would you have? How many family members would be able to stay together? We just came out of Thanksgiving. We're about to go into Christmas. And it's already difficult enough to be able to interact with our family at points. Imagine if everything was on the table. How many families could stick together? Could you get a date if he or she was like knew everything you were thinking all the time? Oh man, you would be perennially single. Could you get married? How could you keep a marriage together? What about just really simple things like sitting under a professor and you just think, well, she's really full of herself, you know? And she knows when you do that. Or a boss. You know, the boss is really, you know, riding me hard on this. What an idiot. The boss is always an idiot, a moron. How long would you be able to succeed in romance or friendship or family or really anything? Would you be loved or would you be lonely? If you're anything like me, you would be very lonely. Now, let's think about this with regard to God. If human persons, this would be just a total train wreck with our relationships with others horizontally. What would this be like vertically? I've heard people say this very frequently. In fact, many people are banking their entire eternities on this statement right here. Smart people, educated people, you know, professionals, they've got everything in their life put together. They've got their, you know, 401k and they got their career and their degrees and their house and their tax, everything's put together. And yet when you ask them, where are you going to spend eternity? This is what they say. I think I'm good enough to go to heaven. Wow, you think you're good enough to go to heaven. Well, from what we just read, this idea that God knows everything. He knows what you've been doing, who you've been doing it with, what you think, what you feel, how you act, word, deed, and action, everything. Right there, if we are dealing with the omniscient, all-knowing God, that should make us sink a little bit. If this would ruin regular relationships, how much more would it be relationally alienating with God who knows everything? And so when we read in Scripture, we see repeatedly that no one is good enough. Obviously, no one here is good enough. That when we look inside our own lives, we see we don't measure up. Isaiah puts it this way at the end of the book. He says in Isaiah 64, verse 6, we are all infected and impure with sin. Our righteous deeds, catch this, our righteous deeds are nothing but filthy rags. Now, I am a big proponent of Bible translation. We should actually know what that actually says in English from the original Hebrew. And it doesn't say filthy rags. That language refers to menstruation rags. Our righteous deeds, these great deeds, I'm good enough to go to heaven. Those righteous deeds that I'm standing up in front of God, those are menstruation rags from God's perspective. When he sees all of the underlying thoughts and motivations and really just the big picture of your life. Or as Paul puts it in Philippians 3, now in this context, Paul is saying that he was the best of the best, morally speaking. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees, one of the most religious people in that day. He was meticulous with regard to the moral law. Every single law, he said, I kept it, I was blameless. And yet he says, for Jesus' sake, I have discarded everything. Counting it all as garbage. There's another one of those words that doesn't quite translate into English. At least the translators just can't quite bring themselves to translate what that means. The word skubalon in Greek, now I'm getting this from an academic Greek lexicon. Okay, this is not from a blog. This is from academics who are translating New Testament Greek into English. Look it up, page 1078. Skubalon means shit. This was a junk drawer term in the first century that if you were referring to something as dung or in the latrine or the outhouse, you use the word skubalon. Where am I going with all this? When we go to God, when he knows perfectly well what we've been into, he knows us fully, and we show up to him and we say, God, I'm good enough to be with you forever. And we're holding up bloody tampons in one hand and shit in the other. God is not impressed. He looks at that and just says, I see all the way down to the soul. Oh, this would be definitely relationally alienating. And, okay, we're dealing with individual people, humans. That would be alienating enough. But we're dealing with the ultimate being, God. It's not just like me and you, like what I think of you or you think of me. Who cares about that? We're dealing with the ultimate God, the only set of eyes in the universe that really matter. How do they look at you? Do they approve of you or not? We're dealing with a maximally great being. Coming into a presence or into the presence of God would be, how do you put it? The closest I could come to is psychologically crushing. Have you ever met a famous person? I've met many. I met several Cleveland Cavaliers players. I remember being a young kid and my mom took me to the store and they were signing basketballs. I remember looking up at Brad Doherty and he was 9 foot tall. It was like him and Goliath. It was like, whoa, this guy is enormous. Larry Nance, Mark Price. I met an American president, brought him popcorn when I was 15. I met a power lifter, a bodybuilder, later became a movie star, later became a governor, California. Also known as my childhood hero. I met him twice. I remember seeing him and just thinking, this is it. This is the end. You know, I mean, like just seeing this guy in the flesh, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I just could not believe it. It was like my hero. And he looked right at me and just looked right through me. It was pretty painful. Anyways, I'm not like a starstruck kind of person, but like there's sometimes you get into the presence of people that are like stronger, smarter, more loving, more charismatic than you, and you're around them, they're more popular, they're famous, they're a celebrity, they're a musician, and you get around them and you just feel this crippling sense of defeat. You know what I mean? It's like they're so great and you don't know what to say, you don't want to sound stupid coming into their presence, because the greater the person, the greater their value is. And so you come into their presence and it's just like you get tongue-tied. I don't know how to explain it. That's why they call it starstruck. How would it feel not to come into the presence of a bodybuilder or a musician or an athlete, but to come into the presence of God? Infinite in strength, infinite in love, infinite in knowledge. To come into God's presence would be crushing. Here's an example. Okay. Jennifer Garner, she was a very famous actress. All the girls loved her. All the guys loved her when she was younger. Now she's kind of fading out, getting older. Her idol when she was a little girl was Julie Andrews. Julie Andrews was like, she was the bee's knees back in the 1960s, all right? Everybody loved Julie Andrews. They thought she was incredible. Sound of Music, she did other movies too. Anyways, she was a great actress, singer, writer. And Katie Couric calls up Jennifer Garner, knowing Julie Andrews is like her hero. And she gets her on the phone. Here's the clip. See what you think.
Hello?
Oh, is this Jen?
Yes.
This is Julie Andrews, Jen.
Oh, my God.
Hello.
Oh, my
God. I want to tell you, I'm a huge fan and love what you do. And Katie was just telling me that you were pretty... admiring of me too. So I thought, well, let's just have a chat.
Oh my God.
How are you?
Oh.
Why haven't I ever met you, Jen? I would love to, and one day.
I saw you from afar once, but I
want the two of you to meet and have lunch at some point.
That would
because,
be such fun.
And maybe I'll join if I'm on the West Coast, and it would be so much
You're
fun.
You're some godmother here.
Yes, yes. I feel like I did a little matchmaking. I did a little mitzvah, as they say. But Jen, I'm going to keep talking to Julie.
I couldn't be more delighted, honestly, Jen. And I do hope we have a chance. One of the if you see me anywhere or I see you anywhere, we're going to come up to each other and say.
Now again, you might be like, "Well, who's Julie Andrews?" That's kind of my point. You don't even know. You don't even care. Jennifer Garner cares because that's her hero as a little girl. Many of you are like, who's Jennifer Garner? It doesn't matter. Okay. The point is she's famous. And even she, when she comes into the presence of greatness, crushes, falls down and just can't even, she couldn't even speak. So this is relationally alienating. It's psychologically crushing. Well, I guess all of this would make a relationship with God all the sweeter, wouldn't it? When you think about that, coming into God's presence, he knows me all the way to my depth, everything about me that is just so flawed and violating of others. And it's crushing just to even be in his presence to begin with, and yet he loves me. God knows you completely, all the way down to the core, all the dirt, all the filth and everything, and he loves you thoroughly. Romans 3 says this. Now, this is pretty obvious. Everyone has sinned. We've all sinned. We all fall short of God's standard. Yet, God, in his grace, freely makes us right in his sight. He did this through Jesus Christ when he freed us from the penalty of our sins. This is the great chasm that has been closed through the cross. To come into God's presence, we're not coming into the presence of God feeling totally inadequate and crushed. Instead, he became inadequate and crushed for our sake. He did the unthinkable, taking up human flesh, putting on a body, and dying at the cross so that the penalty and the bridge that separates you and I from God was built so that we could be restored to our Maker, Creator. Another way to put this is that God is the greatest being ever, and he wanted to know about you. This is, you could think about this for the rest of your life and never come to the end of it. That God would want to know someone like me. This is the greatest treasure. You could live 80, 90, 100 years without anything material, and if you had this, you'd be a rich man. How does Paul put it? Galatians 4. Verse 5, God sent Jesus to buy freedom for us so that he could adopt us as his very own children. And now you know God. And then he catches himself and he says, or should I say, now God knows you. To think not just if I come to know God, but does God know me? It's not just that I know someone who's really important. The real issue is that person know about me? Do they know me? And Paul's like, that is more important than anything, that God would know you and I. Well, he says in verse 5, you go before me and you follow me. This idea is probably taken from the Exodus, where God was out in front and guarding from behind as well. He's guarding his people. He's guarding David's life. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Yeah, I love to, whenever we go out, we get into a big chaotic scene and my son will just kind of reach up. His hand goes up, reaches for my hand. Feels so good. I love that. I love being able to hold my son's hand, direct him, you know, just to let him know that I'm there. You know, it's pretty chaotic, but just to let him know that I'm there. You place your hand, God, a blessing on my head. It's like no matter where I am, you're there. I'm right here. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to even understand. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you're there. If I go down to the grave, you're there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the farthest oceans, even there, your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. There's times in your life where things are going really well, real smooth, everything's great, and you don't feel the need for this. Like, who needs guidance when I know what I'm doing? You know what I mean? Support. Your strength will support me. There's times in your life where you just have no, how do you put it, no felt need. You don't feel like you need this. I'm doing fine. Everything's going well. Then there's other times where you realize I've got nothing. I can give nothing. I don't know if I can make it another step. And the idea that God is right there with you, not only does he know you, not only is he everywhere you are, but he's actually there guiding and lifting you up to strengthen you and to carry you even when your strength is totally and fully exhausted. How much would you pay for guidance and support like that? How much would you pay to have strength and support there to guide you during times like this? Gold? How much gold would you pay for to have someone there to guide and to strengthen you? There was a very vivid illustration of this back in 1992, where Derek Redmond was one of the sprinters in the Olympics. This is what happened here. If you've ever had that experience where you feel like I don't think I can finish. I'm too broken. I'm not like other people. I can't make it. Can I really do this for another year? Can I do this for another five? Like, and you're just kind of limping along. You know what I mean? Like, you look at your life and you just don't think you can make it. And time again, God is right there. And he just, in a palpable, real way, carries you through these times that by the time you get to the other end of it, you realize, how did I do that? And the answer is, you didn't. How much would you pay for support like that, strength like that? David is just marveling at this. He says, you made all my delicate inner parts of my body. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You know what he's saying? This will sound shocking. He's saying this. I love how you made me. I love how you made me. I've talked to so many people that when they wake up in the morning, they look in the mirror, they hate what they see. I remember talking to one man, and he said, I hate myself. Literally, word for word. I'm not paraphrasing. I hate myself. What a terrible thing to say about yourself. When David looks at himself, he says, I am wonderfully complex, marvelous, marvelously made. How well I know it. It's not just that it's true, but I believe it. I know it. God, the way that you made me is, well, what's that word even mean? Wonderfully complex. It means, quote, different, striking, remarkable, outside of the power of human comprehension. This is the same word used of the miracles in the Exodus, that when we look at those miracles, we say, well, that that's something special. For God to bring the frogs and the locusts and the splitting of the Red Sea and to do all that, that's a miracle. And the same word is used to describe you. Derek Kidner says this could be legitimately translated, awesomely wonderful. How about that? When you wake up tomorrow morning to brush your teeth, you look in the mirror, awesomely wonderful. Verse 15, you watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the darkness of the womb. You saw me before I was born. You know that right now in our culture, 4 out of 10 babies are born to parents out of wedlock. Mom is going to the hospital. Dad's not there. No dad. That's not what this is saying here. God was right there. You watched me as I was being formed. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had even passed. You've been with me before. You knew about me. You've been with me now, and you will always be with me. So he concludes, how precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of sand. And when I wake up, there you are. You're still with me. He concludes in verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you. So David realizes God knows him from stem to stern, fully, totally, and exhaustively. So why would you hide? Why would you hold anything back from God? You know what I mean? If God knows you like that, you have the freedom, the total freedom, just to say, God, you know me better than I know me. So point out anything you see in me that offends you. I can't even see it. Very often, I'm pretty deceived on my own issues. And so to ask God not to look within myself in some kind of a morbid, weird way, what's wrong with me today? Instead, ask God, God, you reveal it. Let's think about that. Is there anything in your life right now that you've just dogmatically refused to hand over to God? I don't know what it is. I don't know you the way God knows you. I'm guessing you know exactly what it is. Is there something in your life that you're like, I know God has been speaking to me about this. Feels like every time I'm sitting under the word or I'm in prayer, it just comes right to mind. Can't sit through a Bible teaching without thinking about it. And it's like, okay, why don't you just want to hand that over to him? If God is calling on you to hand something over to him, it's not because he needs it. It's because it isn't worth anything in the first place. Take it easy on yourself. Put it into his hands where it belongs. And you will feel just a lightening of the soul, of the spirit, where it's like that fighting, that tension with God, all of a sudden it's just like, that's not there anymore. And you get into this new level of enjoyment of people and love relationships. Point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of everlasting life. So I suppose the first decision that we spoke of tonight would be, have you received the gift of God through Jesus into your life? Right? Have you been forgiven? Has that huge alienation that we spoke of been resolved? Have you been reconciled to God? Has that happened? Well, for David it was. He said, you know me, we're together. And now he's saying, now that I know you, in that order, now that I know you, I want you to lead me. So if you know God, and God knows you, and you're in a relationship with him, now it's time to ask yourself, do I want him to lead me? This part is optional. You can decide to do this or not. It's up to you. But if you choose to do this, what you're saying is, I choose to trust your words more than how I feel. It's very easy just to say to God, yeah, you're leading my life. Great. What we mean by that is, I'm choosing to trust what you say more than how I feel. Or another way to put that is, you know, God, you say one thing, but I feel differently. Which one of us is right? For many people, they get kind of confused about that. For the Bible reader, somebody trained with a biblical mind, they know God's the one in the right, so I got to work through this with him. What we mean when we say that God's going to lead us, it's not nebulous, it's not real vague, it's saying I'm going to trust to follow you even when it hurts. I made that decision April 19th, 2005. I'm not going to do this perfectly, I already know that. I'm in this till the end. There's no quitting, there's no stopping. Yeah, we're saying when we say, God, lead me, I'm trusting you to grow me into a more loving person. That's what we're saying. We're saying when we say, lead me, that I'm going to dedicate my life to fellow Christians. You say, wait a minute, I thought this was just, you know, me and God, okay? But God lives among his people. When we read our Bible, when we read the New Testament in particular, what we see repeatedly is to love God is to love your brother. So I'm going to take the risk, the mighty risk, to put my life out there around all of these strange, weird people and actually to open up my heart to them. And reciprocally, they're going to do the same. We're going to love one another until we learn how to love the way Jesus loved us. And when we say that we want God to lead us, we're saying, and when I fail, not if, but when, we're saying, I'm agreeing that I'm going to keep turning back to you. Have you made a choice to let God lead your life? If you've never made this choice where you've consciously said, I'm with you to the very end, I just want to put that on your mind. I want you to think about that. Because what we're talking about here is the greatest life. It is the best life. Jesus was the one who said, I came to give them joy and to give it to them abundantly. So, if you're thinking about this, keep thinking about it. Keep praying about it and ask yourself, what am I holding back? Why am I not wanting God to lead me in these different areas? And he'll reveal it to you. He promises that he will.